We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Thursday, July 14th, 2016, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus the American Coal Company and the United Mine Workers of America, et al. Docket number Lake 2011-13. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, Commissioner Cohen, Commissioner Nakamura, and Commissioner Altman. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Sarah Stewart. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. This case comes before the Commission on Interlocutory Review. In this proceeding, the Secretary essentially is challenging whether the Commission's authority to review settlement agreements is more limited than that described by the Commission in its August 2012 Black Beauty decision. In that decision, the Commission concluded that Section 110K of the Mine Act explicitly authorizes the Commission to review proffered settlements of contested penalties. The Commission considered the language of 110K, the legislative history, and the Commission's procedural rules to conclude that the judge did not abuse her discretion in requesting further factual support for a proposed settlement and for considering the deterrent purposes of the penalty scheme in her review of the settlement proposal. This case arose when the Secretary in February 2013 filed a motion to approve settlement and dismiss proceedings. The settlement agreement involves 32 citations issued in approximately 1 month's time in 2010, 14 of which are designated as S&S. Under the agreement, American would accept the citations as written, but pay a 30% across-the-board penalty reduction. The settlement agreement states as the rationale for the reduction in penalties. After further review of the evidence, the Secretary has determined that a reduced penalty is appropriate in light of the party's interest in settling this matter amicably without further litigation. In recognition of the nature of the citations at issue and the uncertainties of litigation, the parties wish to settle the matter with a 30% reduction in the total assessed penalty with no changes in gravity or negligence for any of the citations at issue. The judge denied the settlement because the motion failed to provide adequate factual support for the penalty reductions and noted that an across-the-board reduction of 30% for each of the citations was itself a red flag. The judge directed the parties to provide information sufficient to establish that the penalty reductions protect the public interest. The Secretary subsequently filed a motion for reconsideration. In the motion, the Secretary requested that the judge reconsider his legal conclusions that Section 110K compelled him to reject the settlement for lack of factual support, and that Section 110K does not permit the Secretary to negotiate settlement agreements structured as uniform percentage reduction of penalties. The Secretary's counsel stated that exercising her professional judgment as a representative of the Secretary, she considered the value of the proposed compromise, the prospects of coming out better or worse after a full trial, and the resources that the Secretary would need to expend in going through a trial. The Secretary, through the undersigned counsel, represents that the proposed penalty is in the public interest and is compatible with MSHA's enforcement goals. The judge again denied the motion for approval of settlement. The judge found that the Secretary had not altered the terms of the original settlement agreement or provided further explanation to justify it. The Secretary subsequently filed a motion requesting that the judge certify his ruling for interlocutory review, which the judge denied and issued a certification for interlocutory review on his own motion. The Secretary then filed a petition for interlocutory review of the Commission. In light of the judge's certification and the Secretary's petition, the Commission issued an order granting interlocutory review and described the issue on review as whether the judge erred in denying the Secretary's motion to approve settlement. The Commission issued an order allowing intervener participation by the United Mine Workers of America and the United Steel Workers, and amicus participation by former Congressman George Miller. On review, the Secretary contends that the judge erroneously denied the settlement proposal and rejected across-the-board percentage penalty reductions based on an incorrect reading of Section 110K. He contends that Section 110K should be interpreted in light of the separation of powers principle that settlement decisions involve policy choices that the U.S. Constitution vests in political branches, not in court-like agencies like the Commission. The Secretary asserts that enforcement agencies are generally presumed to have unreviewable discretion to settle enforcement actions. He submits that such a presumption can be overcome only where the controlling statute both indicates an intent to circumscribe agency enforcement discretion and provides meaningful standards for defining the limits of that discretion. The Secretary asserts that Section 110K does not provide any meaningful standards for judicial review of settlements and only indicates that the Commission's role is no different than that of a generalist court. The Secretary further submits that Section 110I cannot supply the standard that Section 110K does not provide, that the legislative history does not provide a standard for limiting the Secretary's prosecutorial discretion, and that any Commission procedural rules that provide a substantive standard exceed the Commission's authority to promulgate only procedural rules. The Secretary argues that when reviewing settlement proposals, the Commission should apply the consent decree standard of review applied by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and SEC versus Citigroup Global Markets. Under that standard, the Commission would consider whether the proposed settlement is legally sound, is clear, resolves the claims in the penalty petition, and is not tainted by improper collusion or corruption. The Secretary argues that under this standard, he is entitled to deference with respect to his determination that the proposed settlement is in the public interest. American filed a letter indicating that it concurs with the Secretary. In their intervener's brief, the UMWA and the United Steelworkers argue that the judge correctly denied the settlement motion. They state that Section 110K plainly requires that proposed settlements be approved by the Commission and delegates to the Commission the authority to effectuate that mandate. The interveners disagree with the Secretary's argument regarding the separation of powers principles on the basis that the Commission is not a judicial branch, owing deference to unreviewable settlement decisions of a unitary executive agency. They explain that rather, the Commission is an independent agency in a unique split enforcement scheme that is expressly authorized to approve the Secretary's proposed penalties. In his amicus brief, former Congressman Miller agrees with the position of the interveners. He states that under the Secretary's position, there would be no transparency of the reasons for penalty reductions, which was a principal reason that Congress articulated for adopting Section 110K. The amicus states that Congress enacted a unique split enforcement scheme in the Mine Act, granting to the Secretary the discretion on whether to cite an operator, what violations to cite, what penalties to propose, and whether to withdraw citations, while granting to the Commission the discretion over how large a penalty should ultimately be assessed for contested violations. He contends that the Commission and courts have an obligation to give effect to Congress's choice. The amicus further argues that any ambiguity in Section 110K should be resolved by deferring to the reasonable interpretations of that provision by the Commission, which is reflected in the Commission's procedural rules and decisions, such as the Black Beauty decision. He suggests that the Commission should reject the Secretary's suggestion that the consent order standard is applicable because there are many consent order standards. He submits that in any event, the consent order standard articulated in Citigroup 2 is rigorous and would not allow the Secretary the discretion and settlement that he seeks. Therefore, the question on review is whether the judge erred in denying the Secretary's motion to approve settlement. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Since there's no questions at this point for Sarah, I will start our deliberations with Commissioner Cohen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I want to thank Sarah for a really excellent memo and one that I basically agree with. In my view, this case is really quite simple. It is about the solicitor's insistence that the MSHA CLR acted properly in failing to provide any factual basis in support of a motion to approve a settlement agreement. The proposed settlement agreement involved 32 separate citations, which the Secretary proposed to settle with an across-the-board 30% reduction in the penalties and no changes in the designations of gravity or negligence. The entire justification for the proposed settlement was as follows, and I'm going to read it. After further review of the evidence, the Secretary has determined that a reduced penalty is appropriate in light of the party's interest in settling this matter amicably without further litigation. In recognition of the nature of the citations at issue and the uncertainties of litigation, the parties wish to settle the matter with a 30% reduction in the total assessed penalty, with no changes in gravity or negligence for any of the citations at issue. Citing the Commission's August 2012 decision in Black Beauty, Judge Moran rejected the proposed settlement because it failed to provide any factual basis for the 30% reduction in penalties. At that point, a very interesting thing happened. The Solicitor's Office could have provided some factual explanation for the penalty reduction. This has happened in many other cases, and Commission judges have then proceeded to approve the proposed settlements. But rather than providing any factual basis, the solicitor doubled down. She submitted a motion for reconsideration and a supporting brief in which she argued that the motion to approve the proposed settlement agreement was perfectly sufficient. In this motion, the solicitor argued that the commission has no authority under the Mine Act to require any meaningful explanation of a proposed settlement, and that any commission pronouncements to the contrary are ultra vires, is her words. Judge Moran then issued an order denying the motion for reconsideration, and the secretary filed the present PIR. The nub of the solicitor's position was acknowledged by counsel at the oral argument 2 days ago. It is sufficient to chant the mantra of uncertainties of litigation, and no further explanation is needed. Of course, there are always uncertainties of litigation. The solicitor's mantra is nothing more than a truism applicable to any legal situation. It has no content whatsoever. The solicitor in her briefs erected a grand theoretical structure which has nothing to do with the reality of this case. She put it in terms of commission judges seeking to independently assess penalties contrary to the proposed settlements. I consider this to be pure obfuscation, which can be seen by looking at the solicitor's conduct. She deliberately picked as a test case a proposed settlement of 32 citations, each for 70 cents on the dollar, with its only justification being the uncertainties of litigation. It may be that there exist cases where commission judges go overboard and reject settlements, which they should approve. We don't know. We don't know because of the solicitor's deliberate litigation strategy. I put a hypothetical question to the Secretary's counsel at the oral argument involving a situation where MSHA presents a proposed settlement to a commission judge with an explanation of the facts supporting the reduction in penalties, and the judge rejected the settlement. I asked, why couldn't the Secretary then bring that case before the commission and argue that the judge's rejection was unjustified? There was no answer other than the claim that they did present factual support in this case. The solicitor justifies her position in a number of ways, none of which I think are valid. She begins by analogizing to different areas of law, such as securities regulation, and saying that there exists a presumption of unreviewability of settlements. Thus, she analogizes the commission to a generalist court reviewing a settlement by an agency such as the SEC. Of course, the commission is not a generalist court. It is a special entity created by Congress whose members, the five of us, the commissioners, have been appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate because, as stated in Section 113A of the Mine Act, we are qualified by training, education, or experience to carry out the functions of the Commission under the Act. The Commission was established as part of a split enforcement system, which Congress created because of its dissatisfaction with the previous system of Mine Safety and Health Regulation. In Section 110K of the Mine Act, Congress gave the Commission explicit oversight authority over settlement agreements. Quote, no proposed penalty which has been contested before the Commission under Section 105A shall be compromised, mitigated, or settled except with the approval of the Commission. That language could not be clearer. And Congress stated in the legislative history precisely why it had given this approval power to the Commission. Quote, by opposing these requirements, the committee intends to assure the abuses involved in the unwarranted lowering of penalties as a result of off-the-record negotiations are avoided. I think it is remarkable that the solicitor filed a 55-page brief with fully 10 pages addressed to the legislative history and never once acknowledged that Congress had found abuses involved in the unwarranted lowering of penalties, which Section 110K was explicitly designed to avoid. Then, based on the limited review power of generalist courts in other statutory schemes, the Secretary proposes a four-part test for the Commission's standard of review under Section 110K. This test comes from the Second Circuit and does not include any requirement that the reviewing court inquire into the adequacy of the settlement from the standpoint of the public interest. If one were to read only the solicitor's two briefs in this case, one would think that this standard of review is the only standard which reviewing courts use. However, the solicitor entirely omits mention of the fact that the D.C. Circuit, in a series of cases, relies on a different standard of review, which includes the requirement that the judge determine whether the proposed settlement is fair, adequate, reasonable, and appropriate under the particular facts. One would think that a responsible litigator would present both standards and then argue that the Second Circuit standard was the more appropriate. But the solicitor in 75 pages of briefing failed to do this. The solicitor also makes the argument that under the Supreme Court decision in Heckler versus Cheney, the Commission has no real authority to review proposed settlements because the statute fails to provide meaningful standards for defining the limitations of the Commission's discretion. Heckler was a case in which prison inmates who had been sentenced to death by lethal injection sued the FDA, claiming that the drugs used for the lethal injections had not been approved for that purpose under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. For this reason, they claimed that the FDA was required to approve the drugs as safe and effective before they could be distributed in interstate commerce. The court, in rejecting their claims, held that the FDA's decision not to take the requested enforcement action was not subject to judicial review. The reason was that Section 701A of the APA provides two exceptions to the general reviewability of agency action. The second exception is when agency action is committed to agency discretion by law. The court then interpreted what this language means, relying on its decision in Citizens of Overton Park versus Volpe. In Overton Park, the court had said that Section 701A2 of the APA is a very narrow exception, applicable only in those rare instances where statutes are drawn in such broad terms that in a given case there is no law to apply. The court in Heckler then concluded that the statute applies if the statute is drawn so that a court would have no meaningful standard against which to judge the agency's exercise of discretion. The court then held that the D.C. Circuit, which had granted relief to the prison inmates, agreed with this standard but had applied it incorrectly. The Supreme Court noted that Overton Park did not involve an agency's refusal to take requested enforcement action, but involved an affirmative act of approval under a statute which set guidelines for determining when such approval should be given. The court noted its precedent, which establishes that in situations involving an agency's decision not to take enforcement action, there is a presumption that judicial review is not available. The court explained in detail that it is generally unsuitable to provide judicial review where an agency decides not to take action. There are at least three reasons why the language the solicitor relies on from Heckler v. Cheney is not applicable to this case. First, this is not a case involving the failure of MSHA to take enforcement action, resulting in a presumption against judicial review. Second, this is a case involving a situation, the reduction of penalties in a settlement, where Congress explicitly provided for review by the Commission. Third, the upshot of application of Heckler v. Cheney, as the Secretary urges, is that the Commission would have no power to review settlements at all. Look closely at what Heckler said. If the statute provides, quote, no meaningful standards against which to judge the agency's exercise of discretion, unquote, and this is what the solicitor is arguing, then under Heckler, the Commission would be totally precluded from reviewing settlements at all. This, of course, is an impossible result given the existence of Section 110K. But even if the statute must contain meaningful standards against which to judge the Secretary's exercise of discretion in settling cases, I believe that such standards certainly exist within the Mine Act. First, there is Section 110I, which contains six enumerated factors and which was interpreted in Black Beauty to also include deterrence. We said in Black Beauty, Section 110K, quote, contains no explicit restrictions on what a commission's judge may consider when reviewing a settlement, unquote. That doesn't mean that Section 110K does not provide judicially manageable standards. It means that there may be considerations beyond the six enumerated factors. A settlement may include creation of elements which go beyond requiring payments, but which foster mine safety. For example, in the UBB case, the settlement included many money set aside for training. This is certainly something which judges can consider in determining whether to approve a settlement. The existence of such possibilities does not mean that Section 110I cannot be looked to as providing an element of the judicially manageable standards. The solicitor argues that since Section 110I uses the word assess, while Section 110K uses the word approve, that Section 110I cannot be considered as part of the judicially manageable standards. However, the word assess includes approve. Approve is what a judge does in the special circumstances of a settlement. It is a subset within the larger set of situations denoted by the word assess. When a judge approves a penalty, the act also constitutes an assessment of the penalty. It is the assessment of a penalty within the context of a settlement. So the solicitor's argument that assessment is different from approval goes nowhere. There was no need for Congress to use a phrase like assess and approve in Section 110I in order to show that settlements were included. In addition to Section 110I, the judicially manageable standards present here include the legislative history and Commission Rule 31. The solicitor argues that Rule 31 may not be considered because the Commission has no power to promulgate a substantive rule. This is part of the solicitor's argument that the Commission's procedures, which have successfully approved tens of thousands of settlements, are ultra-virus. Two responses. First, Rule 31 is not a substantive rule. It does not alter the rights of any party or impose substantive obligations or otherwise affect private interests. Rather, it is a procedural rule which directs parties as to how they present proposed settlements to the Commission. Second, Rule 31 has been around in one form or another for over 35 years. If a rule is indeed ultra-virus, that means it can have no applicability. It is void. You would think that if the Commission had so exceeded its powers as to promulgate and utilize a rule which is totally void, the Secretary would have had something to say about this before now. Another curious thing about this case is the inconsistency between the solicitor's attitude toward the Part 100 penalty formula in this case and what their attitude toward that formula is in other situations. Commissioner Young pointed out during oral argument that the Secretary has attempted to propose a rule limiting the power of commission judges to deviate from the Part 100 formula for computing penalties. This suggests that the Secretary puts great stock in that formula. But here the solicitor is attempting to reduce the penalties by 30% based on the uncertainties of litigation, and saying the commission has no power to even seek a factual basis for this action. It is certainly an inconsistent approach to the Part 100 formula. The only consistency is one related to the claim of power. The consistency is that the solicitor claims that she has the power to alter the otherwise sacrosanct penalty formula at will, and the commission must go along. Of course, this consistency is actually totally inconsistent with the power Congress gave to the commission in Section 110K to assess penalties, and it is inconsistent with what Congress said about transparency in the legislative history to the Mine Act. The solicitor expressed concern about being forced to divulge sensitive information. That could be a reasonable concern. However, it is not presented here. There is nothing that we have in this case that permits us to look at that concern in any real way, because that's not the way that the solicitor has brought the case. It is a frontal attack on the commission's ability to request further explanation, factual explanation, and doesn't raise issues of what might be a concern in divulging or not divulging. Nor do we have to reach the issue of across-the-board settlements, because Judge Moran in this case did not say that across-the-board settlements were precluded. In conclusion, I don't think the judge erred in rejecting this proposed settlement, because the Secretary refused to provide any factual explanation other than the mantra of uncertainties of litigation.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen. Next, Commissioner Nakamura.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Jordan. Thank you, Sarah, for your fine memo and all your help in this case. And thank you, Commissioner Cohen, for a very thorough presentation, with which I agree with most of it. Right off the bat, I would say I would find that the judge did not abuse his discretion in requesting additional information before he approved and in disapproving the settlement when he did not get it. Someone asked yesterday whether this was or at oral argument, with whether the Secretary was seeking a solution in search of a problem. We haven't gotten any further statistics, but from the statistics that the Council for the Mine Workers and Steel Workers brought before us, there's certainly a suggestion that there isn't a problem here. Certainly not a problem, which suggested by the Secretary, suggesting that there's a problem of constitutional dimensions here, where somehow our judges are usurping the prosecutorial discretion of the Secretary. There have been, all of these cases that have been settled with the approval of our judges, with only a handful which have been disapproved, but then ultimately approved. This is an unusual case, because, as Commissioner Cohen stated, because the Secretary has, I guess for purposes of this case, has drawn a line in the sand and gave the judge in this case very little to go by except for, the uncertainties of litigation. So let me say this, that I reject the Secretary's formulation of a standard as set forth in the Citigroup Global Markets case. It seems to me that if you adopt, by adopting that standard, the Secretary is really suggesting that we read 110K, Section 110K, out of the statute. And I would note that the way the Mine Act is set up, every penalty proposal that is not either rescinded or where the underlying citation or order is vacated ultimately becomes a final order of the commission. For example, where the proposal is sent to the operator and the operator fails to contest it, Section 105A says that it becomes a final order of the commission. If it is contested, the secretary files a petition with the commission and no answer is filed, and the operator is in default, that becomes a final order of the commission. And the same thing is true, of course, of the judge's final determination after hearing, but it's also true of settlement. It becomes a final order of the commission. The way the Mine Act has been set up by Congress is all those assessments, penalties become final orders of the commission. So, including settlements. And it seems to me when a judge, because it becomes, every penalty becomes a final order of the commission, we, even without 110K, our judges and the commission have some inherent authority to analyze or review the validity of that settlement. The four factors in the Citigroup case are, number one, basic legality of the settlement. I mean, it seems to me, even without 110K, since that settlement is becoming an order of the commission, a judge has to determine its basic legality. For example, I think one of the examples was whether or not the amount of the proposal meets the statutory minimum for that particular violation. Clarity, I think it goes without saying, the settlement has to be clear. Does it resolve the claims in the citation? The judge has to determine that to see if there's anything left to try. Then finally, I think it's inherent in any the authority of any tribunal to determine whether the settlement is tainted by collusion or corruption. So even without 110K, since all these settlements would be orders of the commission, final orders of the commission, I think it goes without saying that our judges would have the inherent authority to review it under those four factors. So it seems to me that 110K has to mean something more than that, that Congress meant something more than what a generalist court, the inherent powers of a court would have in looking at its own, what will become its own order. So that standard in the SEC case, I don't think, if that's what we were to adopt, and that's what the Secretary is suggesting, I think that would mean that 110K is basically surplusage. Congress put that in there for a reason, and that's reflected in the legislative history. I think we accurately determined in the earlier case Black Beauty. Our judges have the authority of determining whether it is a fair, reasonable settlement and in the public interest. Now, you know, the public interest is a broad term, but I agree with Commissioner Cohen that in this case, we don't have any facts to determine whether or not the judge went beyond his authority in rejecting this settlement based on particular facts, because the secretaries took a trial strategy was kind of an all or we want it all approach. We don't have to give you anything except that we want to settle because of the settling this matter amicably in recognition. Without further litigation, recognition of the nature of the citations at issue and the uncertainties of litigation. I think, as Commissioner Cohen stated, that really doesn't tell you anything. Doesn't tell the judge anything. So I think, based on what Commissioner Cohen said and my analysis of how the Mine Act is set up, I think 110K allows the commission to look beyond just these four factors set out in SEC, the SEC case. The other thing I would state is that in looking at the public interest, and there are other statutes certainly that require courts to look at the public interest. There's one case, the Microsoft case that was cited in the Fokker case that the solicitor gave us. That case involved the Latunny Act, which requires a court to review antitrust consent decrees. And one of the standards of review is to determine whether it is in the public interest. The decree is in the public interest. The Mine Act, if you review the Mine Act, the public interest is replete through provisions of the Mine Act. You know, from the beginning of the preamble that says, and when I say the interest, the public interest, I'm equating that with the interest of the coal miner who's working in the coal mine. The preamble talks about, you know, our greatest resource, the miner. There are provisions in the Act which allow the miner to question the discretion of inspectors, that if they modify or rescind an order in the Mine Act, it gives the miner standing to bring an action before the commission, which is somewhat unusual, I think, in enforcement type acts. I think in the antitrust realm, and I think Commissioner Alton may have more experience in that than I do.
I'm a violator.
I think courts do allow interveners to come in if they feel they're being wronged by the defendant. But our act allows miners to question actions taken by the secretary, and so I think there's a special place that the public interest has a special place when we, the commission, are reviewing actions by the secretary. It seems to be that Congress expressed itself in the act that it's something that, because it's a safety an act which provides safety for coal miners, that's something that we have to keep in mind. And the legislative history, specifically, as we set out in Black Beauty, the legislative history, I think it's the Senate report, specifically says that in looking at and approving settlements, the public interest, the interest of the miner, is something that needs to be taken into account. How far a judge can go in doing that, I'm not at this point ready to articulate. I don't think we have to in this case. I think it's enough for us to find and to reaffirm the standard that we set forth in Black Beauty. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Hackmore. Commissioner Alton?
Thank you, Chairman Jordan. And Sarah, thank you. As always, your help is invaluable. I agree with my preceding colleagues that this is a deliberate test case brought by the Secretary. They could have gotten the settlement if they chosen to provide some factual information, as they have in many, many, many other cases. So they really brought this in order to try and see what the standard should be. This case may go beyond us. I would have ruled in favor of, even if we were applying the D.C. standard, even if we applied a standard that we check for whether the settlement's appropriate, I think for the judge to ask for factual information to see if a settlement is appropriate is part of our right and, in fact, duty under the Mine Act. Having said all that, having said that and agreed with my colleagues, I want to say something on behalf of the Secretary. Because I think I sort of understand their position here. And I actually think this the position therein shows not only the legal correctness, but the wisdom of the dissent by Commissioner Young and Commissioner Duffy in Black Beauty. That sets out six penalty criteria. If we tell our judges that, in addition to looking at the penalty criteria, which are all added, aimed at the same goal, and say, in addition to that, you can, as a freestanding matter, look at deterrence. I think, like all human beings, there's a little bit of a notion there of power. I now have the power to decide what will deter operators from wrongful acts. One of the great preachers of the 20th century said that for a preacher, there's two necessary but contradictory characteristics, confidence and humility. I think that goes for us, all of us in government. And so our judges have to have some, and we have to have some humility, all of us. In this particular case, there were 32 citations for a grand total of $44,000. That averages out to about $1,400 a citation. And the Secretary made an across-the-board settlement of 30%, which would have reduced the, on average, the reduction would have been about $400. Now, the citations were obviously not all the same penalty amounts, but they range from roughly $230 to, on the low side, to $5,000. I think the judge actually, let me say this. I don't know. I can't be in the judge's mind. I, as an ALJ, wouldn't want to try 32 citations. I'd expect this case to settle. And I'd expect it to settle because 32 citations, when you can get this reduction, is not worth interruption of the inspectors, the solicitor's time, actually the cost of the operator, or the cost of the government of my time. So I would have expected this to settle. So this is clearly a test case. They could have got it settled. However, I think when they came forward with their justification, he could have reasonably understood what they mean by that is. The expenditure of resources on these cases and the likely result dictates an across-the-board settlement. So I certainly don't rule out across-the-board settlements. I think often they'll be in the public interest. So I certainly wouldn't rule that out. I also noticed that the judge in this case offered two settlements as exhibits of good settlements. In one of those exhibits, the penalty amounts were settled for 50% of the penalty, and the citations were left unchanged with respect to all aspects. And the legal rationale set out in the settlement was, without conceding respondents' argument, but given the conflicting evidence and associated litigation risk, the acting secretary has agreed to reductions of the proposed civil money penalties. Very little more than this case. The only addition is that they offered some facts. So, but of course, the secretary.
What is this in connection to? This is a different.
The judge in this case attached into his rejection of the motion for reconsideration, attached two sample settlements.
In which he had approved
settlements. So this is language he found acceptable. And I don't expect the secretary to concede the operator's right in agreeing to settle a case. I don't know if the letter they submitted with objections that have been raised by judges is correct or not, but they say that judges have said that have complained that the counsel failed to state whether he consulted with the inspector. I don't think that's our business. It's probably a deliberative privilege in the first place, but secondly, how the secretary arrives at a settlement is not our business. Our business is the appropriateness of the settlement. We shouldn't be telling the secretary how to go about deciding to settle a case. Secondly, he said the counsel did not see if respondents' factual contentions were correct. I would never expect the secretary to say the respondents' factual contentions were correct. Just that there's factual contentions made that, if proved true, would result in loss of the citation or a reduction. I'd also point out, I don't think it is our, in looking at the settlement, we are not assessing penalties. So judges are not looking at it as if everything were true, for example, in this case, that all this is true, and I would assess a different penalty. I wouldn't settle for this amount. That's not our judge's role. Our judges have a critically important role of making sure settlements are appropriate in the public interest. But I think we should all be mindful that the secretary is the enforcement agency. I don't think there's any concern. I mean, I understand the legislative history that Mesa had non-transparent settlements and they thought deals were being cut, and maybe they were. I weren't around. I don't think anybody's concerned about MSHA being the strict and tough enforcement agency at this point. Commissioner Young pointed out the metrics are very good. So the notion that there's some sort of softball agency giving easy settlements, I think, is inconsequential. I don't agree with the statement that I think one of the reasons some Supreme Court justices gave little weight to legislative history is that sometimes they get into Senate reports things that are simply foolish and, you know, no rational person believes. And that, in terms of that money is no object, that's silly. And that's not of any importance here. Certainly, the solicitor's office has lawyers. It's not going to bring on all of a sudden lots of extra lawyers to try cases in the absence of a big deluge. So they have limited time, limited budgets, and they have to prioritize, as with their work and with the inspector's work in coming out to try these cases. So with all that, I still certainly am going to affirm this judge. And if the secretary briefs this case to the circuit court and wants to identify some of the problems brought about by Black Beauty, and circuit court could even in an advisory role opine on that, I certainly think that would be valuable. I think that's it.
Thank you, Commissioner Alton. Commissioner Young?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And thank you, Sarah, for your consistent mastery of the act and the record. In this case and the other cases that you prepare for us, it's always very helpful to me. I'm going to agree with everybody, including Commissioner Alton, in having some caveats for us and some appropriate recognition of the Secretary's role and the difficulties inherent in that. I was ostensibly a trial lawyer early in my career. I didn't try a lot of cases. But boy, I settled a lot of cases. I settled a lot of cases, and it's a process that's not always susceptible to a precise analytical review. A lot of times you have to go on what you feel is the best you can get under the circumstances that your client will accept. And a couple of the best cases that I had, they're the most factually interesting, and I was sure I was going to get to try these cases because my client said, I'm not going to pay this guy a dollar. Not going to do it. They wound up taking voluntary dismissals. The plaintiff in one case literally disappeared, and the other one, the lawyer took a voluntary dismissal, because they weren't especially good cases, and the client dug in. Sometimes, though, when you're a lawyer, you're looking at it, the client's going to say, I don't think there's any way we could lose this case, but I don't want to spend $20,000 trying this case. I just don't. In the world where you have a client who gets to make that kind of decision, settle the case. I think it's interesting and somewhat ironical, and I've noticed this in a different case, that the secretary raises a constitutional objection to what we're doing here. But as a constitutional matter, the secretary, MSHA, has no power at all to do anything except what Congress has conferred upon it. It is a complete creature of Congress. Everything it does, Congress directs. Congress made a decision. You're not going to assess penalties. You're not going to settle cases without the approval of the commission. And as Commissioner Nakamura, I think, really brilliantly analyzed it, this is everything that we do is reduced to a final order of the commission, and everything that MSHA does in the enforcement process has no effect unless it becomes part of and subject to a final order of the commission. So I agree completely with what you said about that. Furthermore, I thought it was a tremendous insight that you had about the power of minors under the provisions allowing them to contest the modification or termination of orders. And also, if you look at 105C3, if the secretary decides this is not a violation of the act, the minor may yet proceed and may yet seek to get what everybody wants, final order of the commission, on his or her own behalf. It's important to note this because if the secretary were to try to get something, the only way they would get it is for the judge to order us to issue something. And to do that, the circuit court is going to have to ignore the clear and express will of Congress that the commission makes those decisions. Looking at how the secretary goes about this process and what they propose to us, I don't think it's inherently unreasonable to consider that there might be standards, but I found it interesting that they would select the non-class action standard and try to approach that. I believe that not only are the minors the ultimate public interest in this case, but they are the representative class of persons whose interests we must always be vigilant over in determining how these cases are decided. Everything that we do ought to be looked at from that perspective. What is in the best interest of our most valuable resource, the minor? Because that's what Congress has told us to do. So in this case, we look at the situation. I think that it was not an abuse of discretion, in particular because the judge noted the nature of the violations, something cited in a general way by the secretary in its proposal to settle the case. But he was somewhat alarmed about the nature of the violations and the history of the violations at this particular mine. I did note the similarity between the case that was provided as an exemplar in the appendix to the judge's decision and the terms here. I don't think there's a whole lot of significance in the distinction of language between uncertainties of litigation and conflicts in the factual record. But the fact is that this judge is aware, at least in a broad general sense, not in the it's been put before me officially on the record sense, but of what what the basic factual underpinnings are of the case, what the nature of the violations are. And judging is a hard job too. I don't want to second guess what our judges do. I think that that we ought to be justly proud of the service that they provide and the way they provide it as a general matter. But agreeing with Commissioner Alton, yes, you need the confidence in your judges and the confidence in your own ability to manage affairs, but you also need some humility. You know, the job of the secretary is vital also, and difficult, and done with great skill and dedication by many people. When you look at circumstances that arise, I think that we must be mindful and respectful of the secretary's role, not because of that technocratic shibboleth deference, but because it's a recognition of the practical realities of what the secretary has to be able to do and the authority that he needs to carry out his functions under the Act. So if our judges are considering settlements and they do have things put before them, and again, this is not that case, but if they have things put before them that clearly implicate a policy determination made by the secretary, that's something that the judges really need to be respectful of because of the secretary's central role in determining and formulating policy in enforcing the Act. If it's something that's clearly within the realm of the prosecutorial authority of the secretary, again, that's something the judge would have to consider. And finally, in this case, I think that the judge does not have the problem specifically in this case, but it's a potential problem that if you were to look only at the penalties and not consider the settlement as a whole, I think that you could have some difficulty defending a decision not to approve a settlement. In this situation, I think the judge looked at the other factors and the nature of the violation, et cetera. But I'm not sure that had the judge taken a look at this and approved it as it was proposed, I'm not sure that would have been, I mean, I don't think that would have been an abuse of discretion either. To me, just looking at it again as somebody who's been involved in the settlement process, a 30% reduction in the penalty, when you look at the fact that MSHA's getting all of the characterizations, the negligence, the gravity level, everything is preserved, you understand that you arrive at some of these things through one of those permissibly arbitrary processes where, you know, there's nothing that tells you that at 14 minutes, minors will certainly live, and at 16 minutes, minors will certainly die. But they set a 15-minute standard in the Act for some things because you have to set a standard. You have to know where that line is. It's hard to do a settlement and say, well, what is too much? It's going to depend on the case. To me, personally, a 30% reduction in the penalty where you get everything else and where the penalty very often is subordinate to the paper. I mean, the nature of the violations, it affects your destiny in a lot of ways as a mine operator. And that may be more important to the secretary in a given case. Furthermore, I think it's important that we do consider, not just in the abstract, but as it really practically applies, the concerns expressed by Ms. Johnson yesterday about things that you might not want to disclose. We are in an awful, awful small pond. You know, the practitioners who come before us and practice before the commission, it's a rather small club. You know, the inspectors who go out there, it's a relatively controlled and manageable small group of people. We have mine operators who are before us. I don't know, well, we have four or five American coal cases before us right now, again and again and again. And the more you disclose, the more you have to tip your hand, the more familiar your adversary becomes with your process, the more difficult it is to achieve what you really want to achieve. So I think we do need to be mindful of that. But I'm also mindful of this. You know, having said all that, and having said, you know, some complimentary things yesterday about, or 2 days ago about the agency, I think it's important that we remember that there is a distinction between the public interest and the government's interest. And there are cases unfortunately, where the government takes actions or makes decisions for its own administrative convenience, for its own purposes, to serve its own political means, whatever. And it's, I believe it's rare in our context, but I know I've been here when there have been two of those instances involving settlements. The penalty case, where the secretary settled a 105C case out from under the monitor without his consent, tried to, didn't work. And then we had the Maple Creek case, where they managed to treat the union unfairly, in my opinion. And then they turned around and changed tack and tried to treat the operator unfairly. And, you know, things like that don't cover the government in glory. Again, I think they're rare instances, but they're indications of why we need to make sure that we maintain this posture of vigilance and that we reinforce the authority that we have and that Congress has conferred upon us through the way the act was designed and written. As we've decided it in the Black Beauty case. And I think that's what we ought to follow through with here. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. And I also join in thanking Sarah for your helpful memo and follow-up discussions on the case. And I thank all my colleagues here for their very thoughtful and elegant remarks, and I join in agreement with concluding that the judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the settlement when the secretary failed to comply with the request for additional information. I'm not going to reiterate the points. There have been so many points, interesting and helpful points raised by my colleagues here today. But I join in, my focus is basically looking at the statutory provision 110K. It clearly provides the commission with the authority, indeed the obligation, to approve any settlements obtained by the secretary. And it was kind of, I guess, intellectually interesting to a certain extent, you know, to read the secretary's arguments about how, in general, a prosecutor has the discretion to decide whether to prosecute. They have the ability, they have to make these decisions, weigh their priorities. There's indications that make them want to settle a case that are difficult to make public. But and, you know, Heckler v. Cheney line of cases. But in the end, there's a statutory provision. It's pretty plain as far as, in my view, and there's the legislative history to back it up, that clearly the commission is going to play a role. And, you know, what that role will be, I guess, will play out in many cases. In fact, as we've indicated here, it's played out successfully for the most part, you know, since the act was passed and most of the cases are settled. Whether things have taken a different course subject to after the Black Beauty case, as was suggested, I don't know. I don't really know why the Black Beauty decision would necessarily start to push things a different way, but clearly here the judge, there were things that were struck him as a little bit unusual, the across-the-board reduction. I agree with some of my colleagues. I don't think that is necessarily an unacceptable approach, but given the nature of the violations, the number of violations, the approach, was not out of line for him to request more information. Some of the judge's comments, he made the point that the fact the settlement didn't change any of the special findings of the secretary, the significant, substantial, and negligence findings cut against the secretary's justification for accepting a lower penalty. That might not necessarily be true because the retaining of the significant and substantial findings has other implications, as we're aware of, you know, with pattern and all that. Can also be a factor for deterrence. But even, you know, considering the arguments the Secretary has raised, there's the statutory language, there's the legislative history, and I think that the key, you know, that my colleagues have pointed out in reviewing the settlements, that the public, the judge has to assure him or herself that the settlement is consistent with the policies of the Act, doesn't undermine the public interest. And for a judge to decide that he or she needs additional information is appropriate. Can a judge in certain situations wind up going over that line, over what's appropriate? Yes. Might they be tempted to insert their own view of what would be the best resolution of a matter? Yes, you know, that may happen. You know, in the Secretary, they decide to take a test case. Would it be easier for the Secretary and less of a bother to just be able to do some very boilerplate submission to each judge? I mean, yes, they are busy people over there. I fully appreciate that. I don't, you know, I'm not outraged at their attempt to take a shot at it. I don't think it was in light of the statutory language. I don't think it was. But they made a good attempt. And, you know, in the course of that, they have indicated there are some times when, they could be required to reveal things that wind up being detrimental to their ability to try a case should the judge keep rejecting a settlement and force them to go to trial. And, I mean, it did occur to me, this is not that case, but in a situation like that, I mean, they would be allowed again to come up maybe on interlocutory rule, or if things just got to a point, I suppose they could consider whether, you know, the judge had gotten more into a settlement judge role, maybe, and they might have to consider that if they did have to try it, maybe it should be tried before a different judge. You know, I don't know. It just seems that it's not the, while there are various scenarios and problems that could arise if positions are taken to extreme, and there are all these competing interests to be weighed, and in the end, you know, that's a balancing of these interests. But in this case, I do not find an abuse of discretion at this point, and would affirm the judge's denial of the approval of the settlement and remand the matter.
You know, I had the same idea about whether they could come up with some sort of a form settlement, because I can't see a judge approving a settlement if they don't know that the respondent has actually asserted facts that, if proved true, could cause a reduction in the penalty. So I would expect them actually in every case, even with 32 penalties, to say that respondent asserts, and then something about facts that would actually justify that there's an uncertainty in the litigation. You know, in other words, if they don't have any facts to dispute the citation, there's really no uncertainty in the litigation. So I would think maybe, although boilerplate's always hard, but it's something that just actually would require solicitors out there to set out some basic rules if they can do that. You know, I thought that was a good suggestion.
A couple of points. Madam Chairman, you raised the question if things have been different since Black Beauty. And the union interveners in this case pointed us toward an analytical piece in Mind, Safety, and Health News published on October 20th, 2014. And in that piece, they briefly describe 18 settlements over a period of the past 5 years that had been rejected by commission judges. Now, of those, and this was 2 years and some months after the Black Beauty case was determined. So it was about halfway, half of the time was on one side of Black Beauty and the other half was on the other side. And of those 18 cases, 10 of them had been rejected before Black Beauty. So, you know, possibly Ms. Johnson is going to present something to us which is going to show something different, but this indication is not showing any significant change.
I agree that there was, I wasn't saying that I felt.
No, I know.
I was just saying that question was raised, but I agree. I don't think there's been any data that has been given to us to support that. Now, in light of your comment, I don't see that there's nothing stopping us from issuing our decision here. I don't understand that there's an outstanding request for information that we're waiting for before we go ahead and resolve this.
That's a good point. I agree.
Okay. Is that the understanding of my colleagues? Yes. Okay.
Yeah. The other point I wanted to make is that I'm certainly aware that there are situations where judges impose settlements. And in my practice, before coming to the commission, I saw those situations. And in the commission, the experience that I've had here, I have seen at least one case where a judge, a commission judge, dictated to the secretary the terms that the judge felt the case should be settled on. And that is totally wrong. And any situation like that should be brought to the commission's attention. And I for one, would look very carefully at it and with an eye toward looking at that kind of situation as an abuse of discretion.
Thank you. Sarah, do you have anything you need to ask us at this point?
No, I don't.
You feel you can go forward with trying to draft decision for us to review?
Yes.
Thank you. Of course, you're always free to follow up with any of us individually afterwards. Okay, with that, I thank my colleagues, and we will go off the record.
Thank you.